Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the last session. We're going to be having a panel, and we're going to be discussing the value of certification in other industry verticals. Obviously, all of us are so used to talking about security. We take a kind of wider view for a few minutes. Panel members are Mary Bache, Deputy Director of NIAP, John Green, CTO of Aruba Government Solutions from Aruba, a Hewlett-Packard Enterprise company. He's also my boss. John Morris, President of CoreSec, and Sean Wells, Chief Security Strategist, Public Sector for Red Hat. So, the question we're going to start out, I would like each of the panelists to give their opinion of this. What will it take for the standards we commonly use and we've been working on and talking about here this week to be a best practice or requirement in other important verticals like healthcare, automotive, financial, certainly IoT, because I think we've seen a couple presentations, especially today, where IoT is probably one of the least secure and deepest penetrating network applications and set of network devices we've got. I mean, it's amazing they're getting into everything. And so what's it gonna take to make these things part of our industry, part of our standard set? So what do we need to do to make them best practice in our world? Sean?
Sure, so my name is Sean Wells. I work in Red Hat's government group. But within government, we also consider healthcare part of that, as well as federal telcos, like Verizon Federal and AT&T. And some of the conversations we've been having lately is as healthcare and telco adopts open source, they don't necessarily realize there's a difference between what you might find on GitHub versus what you might find in evaluated software. So we had this conversation about FIPS algorithms, and they didn't actually know that it involved more or less like implementation of the algorithms. I would argue a little bit of offensive testing. So that awareness just didn't exist. So we had that kind of conversation with them. And then on the software assurance side, we, as public sector, we've gone through common criteria about 16 times now. And when we start distilling that it is functional attestation, like did we, even something as simple as are audit logs non-reputable in court? Can we use them in Department of, in the US, Department of Justice court cases? We've actually had, in one case it was Bank of America, they actually had legal action with unevaluated software, and their audit logs didn't hold up in court. So awareness of things like that we started to put out there.
Great. John?
Thank you. I think it's a really good question, and it's one that we've been struggling with, and it was part of one of the talks I was giving earlier. And the challenge, I think, in my mind is that in order to have somebody else adopt one of these existing standards, there has to be value. And that value has to be driven by the standard addressing requirements, addressing needs, providing in a cost-effective fashion some sort of assurance or extra security for them. And I'll point to, in the past, FIPS 14-2 has been adopted by other groups like Hollywood with the digital cinema system specification voluntarily on their own went and took a government standard, levied it upon themselves and said, look, when we're distributing movies in electronic format, we don't want them coming out in the internet before they come out in the theaters. So we're going to put cryptographic controls. And how do we get vendors to produce these systems and actually know that they're putting those cryptographic controls in correctly? What's out there that will provide us that value? What's easy to do to get that validation certification? Ha, FIPS 140-2, one at the time, something that we'll look at and we'll draft our standard based on that. So that kind of value proposition has to be there. In order to get that value proposition, there actually has to be input from that industry, from the end users, to be able to change and modify the standard to give them that value. And that's very difficult to do, especially with a long government mandated process for creating the standard.
Okay, John?
So I'll say, I've been at Aruba for a long time now. We sell products to a lot of different industries. Our number one is higher education, and number two is probably healthcare. I'm not sure where government falls. It's maybe number three or four. But we're in all kinds of different industry segments. And I can tell you, not one of them cares about FIPS 140 validations except for federal government, because it's required, because it's part of law. Occasionally, we'll get a query from a customer saying, do you have FIPS 140? Sometimes that's state or local government asking the question. Occasionally, it's financial sector. I think once it was healthcare, but that was only because they were doing some project with the government that they'd have to be interoperable with FIPS 140. So they don't care about it. What they do care about, and this is increasing, is are your TLS cipher suites using MD5? Are you doing 1024-bit RSA certificates? Are you using SHA-1? So indirectly, they actually do care about FIPS 140 because, and sometimes, usually they're not smart enough to actually understand what they're asking for, but they run some vulnerability scanner. Nessus is the worst culprit, and it says, oh, you're using some weak cipher. And we say, oh, well, if you can put your product in FIPS mode, and that'll all go away, and that'll be good. But more and more, they're actually calling this stuff out. And so indirectly, we get a great benefit out of going through government validations, FIPS and Common Criteria both, because they are the requirements that these customers care about. They just don't care about the certification. So I don't know how to change that.
So like Steve said, I'm from NIAP, and our authority lies in national security systems and not these other areas. But having spent many years in NIAP or working with NIAP and Common Criteria, I have to agree with my colleagues up here and say that value is very important and communication is very important. And so one of the things that NIAP's been doing lately, and one of the things that we repeat over and over, is that we have to figure out how to move, we say, at the speed of industry, right? So we have to be able to get our certifications out in the product, within product lifetimes, get these to our customers, and we have to make sure that they know that what they're getting is actually providing them with something. And I think that's the case whether it's for the federal government or for any of these other sectors. Not only that, the communication about what the evaluation does get you, I think, is sometimes where we fall short. So we all know what we get out of FIPS and what we get out of our PP evaluations, but I'm not sure that outside this community that that's very well known. And so getting that to these other, what are you calling them, industry verticals might also be beneficial.
Okay, good. Now, Sean mentioned the value of a certification because it meant their logs were accepted in court. And John was talking about the value of certification, not so much because they wanted the certification, because they wanted certain specifications. Do any of you have any other examples of where the kinds of things we do to meet the certifications end up fulfilling customer needs that we didn't realize, or that's things that they asked for that kind of get masked by the name, but they're really something we need to do? Like, for example, the financial industry has started requiring level 3 on most of the HSMs that they use, and that's a CYA as much as anything else. Are there any others like that that you're familiar with?
About a month ago, Department of Homeland Security in the U.S. had what they called the CIDR workshop, and it was somehow the insurance industry got in front of DHS and said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have national level policies that would affect cyber insurance? So breach response, how do you take care of lost user data or privileged information? So out of that, DHS is working with a couple of, like, State Farm, Allstate, some others, a couple of specialty providers, to create these like 10 segments of information assurance. And some of them are the typical things like follow a configuration checklist, or in the US we have the DoD STIGs. Others are about the algorithmic implementations of how they do data at rest, data in transport. So I think that's going to start to make its way really as a forcing function across oil and gas and healthcare and telco, simply because if they want this insurance, it's now becoming standardized, whereas before it was largely made up.
Anyone else?
Well, I was going to say, unfortunately, I think the answer is there's not a lot of adoption of FIPS because it happened to bring us unexpected benefits, and that's one of the challenges that we really need to wrestle with and ask ourselves why. But I do think that the area that's going to drive it or that is potentially driving it is insurance. And I was actually talking to a large cybersecurity insurance provider, and they were trying to sell policies. And I was asking them what their stance was as far as risk mitigation and differentiation when they assess what's the risk for an individual client, and they priced the cybersecurity insurance appropriately based on the risk profile for each one. What do they take into account? And what they actually look at for the main part right now is just what the potential losses are. So how much PII do you have? How many credit cards? How many people? How many things can we get end up being responsible for when you do lose them? And what they don't look at very hard, they said right now, because they do not have a standard by which they can measure it, is how low a risk are you? So they say they will accept information that shows that they have a risk profile, that they have a risk management, that they've gone through and done analysis, that they've implemented all these systems, that they have security, and then they'll say, great, you're not complete neophytes, and we may put you in our lower categories of risk right now, but they're not changing the risk level greatly, and they're not changing the price they're charging greatly based on that yet. And so I said, well, what if you had FIPS 140-2 and common criteria on all the products? He gave me a blank stare. So I think there is the problem both of the communication, but also, is there any proof, and that's what they will look at from an actuarial basis, that getting FIPS 140-2 on the products will reduce the risk. We right now have to get UL listing on every product that we buy that plugs into the wall, because demonstrably they've shown that there are fewer fires and fewer lawsuits about people burning down houses and businesses because those products were tested for UL listing and don't tend to burn down the place. The insurance companies know that and insist on that and won't issue insurance policies to manufacturers of products who don't get UL listing on their products. The same thing is currently missing in the cybersecurity world and in the cryptographic module world.
To play this, one of your favorite topics, though, you know, we had Heartbleed in a whole bunch of validated crypto modules, and so we have a ways to go, I think, before we're up to the level of UL, I think, but it's a good place to go.
Liability seems to be one of the drivers, certainly for insurance, and I'm sure there were probably some lawsuits over people who were affected by Heartbleed. Certainly in the medical area, liability is a big thing, because back in the previous administration, there was all this talk about Vice President Cheney having a pacemaker that was basically unlocked, and they were worried about people reprogramming his pacemaker. How about that? I mean, how do we address those issues? How do we start educating or selling ourselves as a way to improve on the situation?
One of the things we need to do first, and John brought it up already a couple of times, is inclusiveness to other industries that want to be part of these standards. And I think we're there with common criteria at this point. I think, you know, the community, what do we call them?
Technical communities.
Those provide an opening for pretty much anyone who wants to join in and help make these standards to do so. I think today, almost everybody that's involved in those technical communities is probably focused on the needs of government, military and government. But that's an opening where we can go out to different industries and say, you know, you're an industry in need of a security standard. Rather than make up your own, why don't you join with the Common Criteria community? And you know, if there's some unique thing that you need to make part of the standard, you have the opportunity to be able to do that. We don't have that with FIPS right now, and that's one of the big problems that I see is we sit in here in this conference and we talk about all the possibilities for improvement for FIPS 140, and there's a handful of people who can do anything about that, maybe not even that, in this room. That's a bit of a problem, and so I don't think we're going to get widespread adoption of standards like FIPS until we solve that.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that? So, we know FIPS has one issue, that it's controlled by the Secretary of Commerce, and we can only do a five-year cycle. So that is a problem, and one of the things that's more rapid about the way things work with common criteria is we could produce a new protection profile very quickly. Should we start, but the thing is, FIPS 140 is still the underpinning, because the way that we look at it now, it's the physical security, it's the crypto correctness and interoperability before we start looking at the higher functions. So, yeah, sure, maybe a medical devices PP would be a great thing, but how do we sell that? How do we approach these industries? How do we get, you know, do we have to wait until someone gets their pacemaker reprogrammed publicly? What do we do to get into these other industries? Any ideas?
So the only example I have is a bit specific to Red Hat. So Red Hat provides commercial distribution of Linux, and we compete with, why don't we just call it the shareware, freeware, CentOS, and things like this. So we recently had a situation where a US government agency had a group of systems running community software that was hacked, and a group of systems running Enterprise RHEL, which was not. So the big question was, what the heck happened? Like, what's going on here? Linux is supposed to be Linux. So it was actually the tech director of IED, Neil Ziering, sponsored this. It was a binary disassembly of Linux. And they wanted to go into different code paths of Enterprise versus CentOS, our freeware competitor, and find out what was different. So they took our evaluated bits, common criteria. We had EAL4 with CAP, RBAC, and LSPP, and we felt so special about it. And they wanted to see what was going on. So as they evaluated it, they ended up finding out that I'm going to have to be very specific. We ship a FTP server, and for whatever reason, when it was thrown into FIPS 140-2 mode on Enterprise, everything was evaluated. And when it was thrown into FIPS on CentOS, our freeware, it actually did not execute the FIPS code path. So they thought they were being protected, and they literally just weren't executing a code path. So there's this nice, like, 15-page paper branded by IED that we've been able to give to industry and say, like, look, this common criteria thing, it actually does validate the way we implement software. It actually does validate our software supply chain. And we've used that as, like, a risk assurance conversation, where before we couldn't really give any empirical evidence upon differentiators. So we've started to do that. The FTP servers sound kind of trivial, but in this particular case, it wasn't. So we've gone back and now taken a look at our kernel our kernel APIs for how third-party software can use the crypto provided in Linux, and we're starting to do the same evaluations. And that's been the first time that I have personally seen kind of like this competitive differentiator of product X has FIPS, products Y do not, what's actually different. And I want more of it, but I don't know how to like articulate that, and I don't know where to start about that. And whenever we tell a healthcare provider or a hospital that, hey, we have this thing that actually is from the NSA and it evaluates FIPS versus non-FIPS, it's like crap, and they can't get enough for these risk assurance decisions. But that's really all I've seen. That's really all I have.
I'm curious to see if the move to an ISO standard for all of its problems that have been discussed at this conference, I'm curious to see if that helps, because it's no longer a federal processing standard, it's an international standard. And we do have issues with outside the United States too. Not everybody is so happy with the choice of algorithm selections that we made. An ISO standard might provide a little more leeway in that sort of thing, depending on which, you know, nation state we go to. But I think there's a marketing benefit to an international standard as opposed to a U.S. federal government standard. So we'll see. We'll have to see how that goes, if we can afford the spec.
I would agree with John that I think that the internationalization of the standard is a rare opportunity for the whole industry and the community to reach out to other groups. But in response to how do we get introduced to new groups who are looking to do this, you don't. You'd have to spend resources to do it. And you can look at what's going on with IoT, what's going on with automotive, what's going on with medical. We've been talking to a couple of different groups, and we were talking to them about why aren't they adopting, for instance, in one particular case for the medical industry, for a particular solution, why aren't they adopting the use of common criteria to solve this problem they have with these particular devices and evaluating them against basically not continuing to pump life-saving medicines into people. And so how do you get them to see that this tool, this wonderful tool, this common criteria, would actually be the perfect tool for them to solve their problem? And the answer that we're finding is because the medical industry already has huge trade conferences, large industry groups, large regulatory bodies, and they're all working on their solutions right now. And none of them have on their radar common criteria or FIPS 140-2 or its potential applicability. So they're going to try and solve these problems. They're working on them now, and they're looking for what those tools are. The opportunity I think we have is that as we internationalize, if there is enough buzz, if there is enough information, if there's enough open sharing and dissemination of that information, and this conference I think is one of those things that it's only started in the last 3 years, we only have a few hundred people here, yet that promulgation starts to expand. And so you could look at, say, the RSA conference. I remember when I first started going to the RSA conference, it was a very small conference. It was all crypto geeks and weenies talking about very technical subjects. But that subject matter had a much larger impact and interest level for a wide variety of groups. And it kept growing until such time as it became a networking and sharing activity, where that promulgation of cryptographic knowledge, of solutions, of products and everything started to be fed by that dissemination of information. I would argue that right now we have a little bit of that opportunity with FIPS 140-2, where there are multiple groups over in Asia using and adopting versions of the ISO standard for use in validation programs that they're getting off the ground, whether they be government only or not, as well as in the Middle East, they're starting to look at a lot of this, that they're going to be looking for those solutions. And the more information and discussion that we have, the more likely that they will want to adopt it and change it for themselves. But again, there has to be that venue for them to participate and to have that input to tailor it to their specific needs.
Just racking my brain, the only industry group that I can think of that successfully gotten a security standard out there really is PCI. And that was because it had financial incentives attached to it. And everybody's heard of PCI compliance these days. I can't think of any other industry outside of government that's successfully done it. And part of it's marketing. You know, I've been through other security standards as well. So ICSA, we did firewall certification for a number of years. And the problem is, and I always told those guys, you're not doing enough marketing to make this standard relevant to anyone. Nobody is asking for ICSA certification on RFPs anymore because they don't know who you are, because you're not out there talking to people. And so it is a... Somebody has to take the lead on outreach. Maybe it's CMUF that's going to do that. I don't know. But somebody has to do that. You can be the director of marketing.
Thanks. So it sounds like what we really need to do is start approaching these verticals, especially medical, especially IoT. Financials already kind of getting the clue. What other industries? Okay, so yeah, IoT and medical are the big ones. We just see them as low-hanging fruit, and we need to start being ambassadors and marketers. So all of you get that message. But what other things, who else?
IoT is tough, though, because there's so many new entrants into that market. And I hate to make the bar so high. Like, if I think back to when I joined Aruba in 2003, we couldn't spell FIPS. We didn't have enough money to do it. There was no justification for spending that kind of thing. We would have been locked out of the broader industry completely if we had this high bar of FIPS validation, common criteria, all that. So you want to leave room for people to get into the market, I guess. And IoT is one of those places where maybe it comes back to insurance. You know, it's a risk decision of I want higher risk, or I have higher risk tolerance, or I have lower.
Okay, because there's actually a big split in IoT, because we're already seeing this. There's IoT for business, and like the U.S. Post Office is examining using IoT for everything from package delivery to doing pickups from people's car trunks. On the other hand, you've got the other side of IoT where they're talking about controlling your thermostat in your house, and you're going to be able to turn on your webcams and remotely pop up the dog food feeder. So the thing is, it does seem that there's a split there, and maybe if we start with the industrial side, there may be room for a little more expenditure, because also they have a larger liability when the forklift drops a 10-ton box in the middle of the warehouse. That's a little worse. Well, then again, if Fido doesn't get fed, that might upset people just as badly.
Well, I would
go ahead.
I would just say that I personally have Nest thermostats at home. So now I'm telling you all, so I'm expecting them to be hacked by the time I get home, I guess. But
be nice for at least a day.
Right. I don't think there's much security, if any security, on them, but I can control them over the internet. And one wouldn't think it's a huge security problem, because if you do hack my thermostat, I'm just going to be upset that you've turned on my heat or my coal at the wrong time, I think. But I think as we evolve as a community and an understanding in the marketplace, I don't actually want you guys seeing my thermostat information, because Nest has a motion detector in it. When you walk by, it lights up so you can see it. It's not really worth the $250, but it's really fun. But I thought about that, and I said, well, that tells you what my daily schedule is. You see all of my family walking by all of the thermostats every time they go by. And when we're on vacation, you can very clearly see that no one's walking by any of the thermostats. In fact, it even has a vacation mode that proudly announces no one's using the thermostats here, they've turned down. So where is the common criteria protection profile for a thermostat that isn't gonna cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars and jack up the already inflated price of that thermostat that would give me some value, because I would probably buy that over a Nest? And where is the discussion group with that industry that's saying, here's how we could tailor a new FIPS 140-2 version that allows you to skip all of the self-tests if that's the problem for that little device that it can't meet? I think that's the challenge we have, and the outreach for that I do think is the problem, which is, who here has the resources to put towards that? We struggle to put the resources that we do towards the CMUF and the CCUF, and every time we get a new one, well, that's overhead for my company to send people around the world to work with everybody. And we do that pro bono, if you will, because it has benefits for us and everyone in the larger industry. But I don't have enough resources to put anything towards marketing FIPS 140-2 towards the thermostat industry or to IoT, or I would say the automotive industry is another one. I'd like my car to be a little more secure as we go to a digitally connected car. But who's going to pony up and put that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when you think about the thermostat and they know you're not home, forget about even robbing your house. You're in Florida and they turn your heater off. You come home to frozen pipes. So, and part of it is education. Obviously, our industry in some cases is tasked with informing people of all the ugly things that happen when they're not careful. We're really good about doing that with ourselves and each other, but we're not good about explaining it gently to all the people who might need to pay a dollar more or $2 more for their little appliances. So we're about at the halfway point, and so at this point, any questions from the audience? If you'd like to ask the panel any questions, please step up to the microphone. Nobody wants?
It's not like we know any more than you do, but if we could just complain about stuff, that's okay too.
So I have two questions. The first one comes down to
the one or two dollar point for
the chip that's being made. So there's a certain cost of adding real security to the chip, and it's the SoC vendors that don't want to pay for that because they don't get the value back from the customer. So I think that's the value chain. You're right. You have to get that back from the customer. But the second one I see is export control. So a lot of this stuff is managed as a weapon, and so you need export licenses to move that kind of intellectual property around and sell it to different companies. And I see those as two barriers to selling or getting to some kind of standard that everyone can use. Any comments?
I found the export stuff to not be that bad anymore. It's gotten way better than it used to be. We can't sell to, five countries that are on the bad list, but besides them, pretty much the commercial crypto stuff can go anywhere. If it goes to a foreign government, it's got to go through export control, and we got a person that does that. But overall, it's not too bad. None of our stuff is ITAR restricted anyway. So
this also may be another 197.90 advantage, since they're going to leave a crypto-shaped hole in the standard, and we can do products for different countries. We may have the advantage there with 197.90 coming in that we can get around a lot of that more easily.
Sure, right. People don't want to pay extra for security. Sometimes I can't even get people to care about security. It's like an acquisition checkbox, and after that, well, who cares? The worst case are universities. They'll put Wi-Fi networks up. They're open Wi-Fi networks. They're on the public internet, and there's no firewall. So anybody can come in and do anything they want, and we start talking about our security, and it's just on deaf ears. Nobody cares. I write the security vulnerability advisories for our company too, and people just ignore those things. They don't patch their systems. It's kind of crazy in the sense that there's a segment of the population that's ultra concerned about security now, because the number of, you know, if OpenSSL comes out with a vulnerability, that day there will be 6 emails in my inbox from customers saying, are you vulnerable to this new thing? Like 30 minutes after the advisory comes out. So there's a group that are hyper concerned. And then there's everybody else who just thinks security is gets in the way of using the product, and they just don't care. That's the people that it's hard to figure out what do we say to make them care about this stuff.
Yeah, I just wanted to get back to the insurance side of the house. I think is one of the verticals where you could actually make some inroads because they are very risk averse. And things like in the automotive industry, if you know, you're all of a sudden connected through Wi-Fi and whatnot else, is that perhaps a higher risk, and the insurance company will charge a higher premium. So perhaps it's in the best interests of the automotive manufacturers to incorporate encryption into those devices. Or even, John, you were talking about your thermostat, letting everybody know when you're not home. Perhaps that's something that would change premiums for home insurance, or you know, is your fridge telling your dryer, "Gee, I haven't seen anybody open my door yet," and the dryer says the same thing, and that we need to have the language to speak to the insurance vertical in their language, as opposed to, you know, common criteria and crypto are great for security. Yeah, but what does that mean to me? Well, it means you can maybe charge lower premiums and get more customers, or higher premiums for the high-risk customers. So just if there's something you have further to say in that
Kind of. So I mentioned in the U.S. we have the Homeland, Department of Homeland Security, and they had this like cyber insurance thing. So one of the things that came out was if you do not adhere to some given standard, the idea is the cyber insurance company would hold you in neglect. So they would revoke your claim if there's a common criteria evaluated product, you chose to use a non-evaluated, that is a symptom of neglect, so your claim is automatically denied. So what we ended up doing is we actually worked with NIAP to create draft language vendors can put into their RFPs about commercial vendors, like if you're building a medical device, if you're Ford and you want to buy the next entertainment system. We actually drafted, it's like one or two paragraphs that can go into RFPs that we have, we've only now started to see. So we worked on a bid with Mount Sinai Health. So they wanted some new devices to do medical image scanning. I think it was just x-ray machines. And they actually put that language into their RFP so that when they get their new x-ray machines, it'll have full disk encryption with FIPS. And now that's a procurement requirement. So we kind of, as a vendor, made them aware of it to that outreach discussion. But now we're starting to see security move from like a post-acquisition thing to a pre. And that's fundamental to some of what we're seeing with insurance.
Maybe they can not put a bargain basement Wi-Fi adapter into that $200,000 x-ray machine,
right,
too.
Yeah. So for us, we used it as a competitive differentiator. Like, oh yeah, of course we want you to use FIPS. Linux has FIPS, and now we can kick out some, you know, open source stuff, freeware stuff. So it's been good in that way for us commercially. It also has presented us as kind of a partner to say, hey, did you know these standards exist? Whereas before, we talked to the acquisition people, and they always viewed it as like, you know, IT's problem.
I worry a little bit about insurance. Just using example of being a pilot, I used to be able to rent all sorts of different aircraft, you know, multi-engine, retractable gear, 10-passenger planes and stuff. And the insurance industry has come along and basically killed that entire market. They're so risk averse that nobody can afford to do this anymore. And now I can go to any, you know, airport around the country and I can rent a Cessna 172, and that's about all you can get anymore. All the fun stuff is gone because the insurance company shut that all down because they were just too risk averse there. So I worry if, you know, translating that into our industry, you really have the opportunity to kill a lot of innovation if you take that too far.
Yeah, but there's countermeasures to that. And I think part of it is me being an open source hippie. So I'll probably wear that hat. But one of the things we're starting to do in the common criteria space for applications and application servers is build automated unit tests provided by NSA to a third-party ISV. And as long as you pass, we basically can do continuous delivery of common criteria certs for app servers. So now that third-party cost, the third-party labs are a little bit upset at us. I'm sure there's some in the room. But as we move towards just continuous delivery of common criteria for app servers, that's helpful. And then we're starting to do the same thing with certain, at least in the Linux realm, certain parts of our FIPS 140 communications. So our OpenSSL libraries, we're starting to build automated unit tests. So that way, as we deliver service packs to the operating system, every single one just gets recerted. So our costs are actually becoming less. So on average, we would spend about $300,000 to $500,000 a year across our portfolio of Linux and middleware and identity. Now we're forecasting that to drop to between like $100,000 to $200,000, simply because our ability to do that unit test.
Any other comments?
Oh, no, I'm new topic. So I felt like I was sitting in a different universe a bit when, with my other hat on, I work on products where in the IoT, where the FIPS requirements would require our design to be 20 times bigger for an equivalently secure set of features. The idea that FIPS can come along and say, hey, IoT, we've got great stuff for you, is laughed at. We find ourselves subject to certifications from people like Modan, who do an invasive set of tests to see, are you keeping the keys secure for markets like media and DRM and those kinds of things. But that has nothing to do with FIPS. And the criteria that are being applied are to do with, are you, have you got a secure product that's achieving a particular goal, like keeping a key secure, but are not focused on telling you which algorithms to use. They will make sure your algorithms are secure. They will make sure you've done all the right things for policies and whatever. But if you get to pick from a limited set of algorithms where you need AES in a PRNG or you need SHA-3 in your message hashing, that's ridiculous. That for IoT. If you want to have FIPS certification in an IoT context, you need to fix the choice of algorithms. You need to fix the way keys going across graphic boundaries. You need to adopt the kind of features that work with user interfaceless devices like zero-knowledge protocols, pairing crypto, and all that good stuff, because that's what's required. And then the lightweight algorithms are also a prerequisite, or you're not going to go anywhere in IoT.
So, any comments?
So just to echo John from earlier, I think that's where the feedback loop comes in, right? That's where the collaboration with the industry as well as the users needs to come into the process. And once we have that, then we can make those strides to make it work for these other industry verticals. But until we have that, that's where we have these problems.
Any other?
So one of the things, again, with the open source hippiness, we worked with IED to put all of the common criteria protection profiles on GitHub. So one of the challenges, at least in the operating system space and app server.
Not all, but
sorry. Yeah, I'll qualify that statement. So one of the things we started to do is we've been very limited in like community engagement on how people, if people have an opinion that the operating system protection profile is not sufficient. There really wasn't a good way as a general healthcare provider or device provider to figure out how to get engaged. So we now have that, where if I remember correctly, the operating system protection profile was developed in like 2 months. It had over 15 or 16 different industry partners with Jeff Blank and team, and now we're starting to accelerate like how to get into these fringe cases. So in the operating system space for IoT, it's being levied upon us as Red Hat to actually have all of our kernel crypto FIPS certified. So ISVs running on like a x86 based IoT device can inherit our crypto boundary. So it's effectively free to them unless they choose to implement their own crypto for whatever reason. So we're starting to see that as kind of a forcing function for participation.
Okay.
I think so. Going back to the original question, I think so. It boils down to no one has been able to quantify in a consistent manner how does the product become more secure, better, more trustworthy by going through the certification standards. And unless you do that, the question that you'll get from industry is, why should I care about it? I would bet that majority of the vendors in this room and playing in this community would not be pursuing certification if it wasn't a procurement requirement. So now if you take this to the other industries, it's not a procurement requirement. Why should someone care?
I think that's an excellent point, Ashit, and I think that's part of the challenge we've had in communicating it. But I would argue that there is a reason to care, and you can see that happening all the time. So I gave the example of Hollywood looking at piracy and saying we need to do it. I had a friend I did Taekwondo with when I was young, and he was actually worked for NSA, and he helped design crypto systems there. He left that, went into the industry, and he worked on DivX. They had hired him and looked for that to, again, deal with piracy of that. So not a good resume, unfortunately, but it was the industry trying to put cryptography on. So there are needs, there are desires, there are security problems. And you can look no farther than the automotive industry right now, who is very active in trying to come up with security standards. We've been talking about the medical industry. They're actively developing security standards right now. There is a need. But I think the comments earlier, absolutely, there is a disconnect between what FIPS 140-2 in particular has to offer and what some of these industry verticals actually need. And the disconnect is very wide. It's so wide, in fact, that many industries are literally washing their hands and walking away and not even considering it as a platform to build upon. And the question would be, in my mind, is there a way to get that feedback, to get that communication, to get that in there to say there is a rich tool set, you can do a lot with Common Criteria. There's an amazing infrastructure around FIPS 140-2 that took over a decade to build to allow these evaluation processes, laboratory evaluation, all of the like, to exist. That could be leveraged. But right now, there are barriers to doing that. And so it's only through, I think, things like the CMUF where we would get folks together and say, here's the needs, here's the desire, here's the problem. But you'd have to have resources from the government side to be able to listen and participate and put resources on it. And that's the disconnect I think we have.
I don't know. I may be sticking my head in the noose, but maybe there needs to be a FIPS 140 light for non-governmental use or something like that or some other standard that can dovetail in and get the essence of what we're trying to do without all that weight for some of the lighter weight products. I don't know. Any thoughts?
So I just think that the challenge there, and I don't want to speak for NIST, but the challenge that I think that NIST has there and the challenge that NIAP has is that we have certain authorities, right? So FIPS for not government, that they are for government. That's
right.
What they do, right? Just like we are for national security systems, that's what we do. So doing something and saying, you must use us in these other places, that's a real challenge for us, and it's not something that I think that you're going to see happen. Now, from our perspective, we have had some conversations with some of these other places, and while maybe not huge strides, but it's a little bit of a turning point, they're saying, we're hearing things like, well, we see what you're doing and we like your requirements, so I'm going to point to your requirements, but maybe not mandate your certification. And I think that is at least starting to turn that corner so that we can have these conversations. And again, not that I will ever be able to mandate my program in these areas, but we can at least maybe provide some assistance in getting that security that's needed.
Okay. So it was interesting. I heard somebody mention the RSA conference. Have you been there recently? How many crypto vendors are there?
I stay away.
How many? So if you walk the floor of RSA today, and I swear there's a point behind this somewhere, if you walk the floor of RSA today, you see one out of 100 vendors that are specifically in the crypto business, maybe some authentication, maybe some access control. What you see are vendors doing all the pieces you need to build a security operations center. all the stuff you need to look for the bad guys. So I think one thing that that this group may need to understand is that your barriers to getting acceptance for FIPS 140, it's more than just the other industry verticals not understanding the importance of encryption. It's the fact is, as they come to this new world of security, which has now been branded cybersecurity, they don't see encryption. They see tools to collect data and analyze the data to look for the bad guys. So for FIPS to be relevant, FIPS 140 to be relevant in that world, a world where you find a problem and then you have this long, complicated effort to figure out how to get them out once you found them, or you identify them as they're coming in and you start putting barriers. By the way, the things you do are you reduce access, you change authentication methods, you change behavior. For you to be relevant, the actions that you would take on the crypto side have to be fast, they have to be agile. In fact, I'm starting to echo now what we just talked about. You need to take the part of FIPS that matter, the automated testing, the ability to go out and say, oh, these crypto components are good, I'm monitoring them, I'm watching the way they behave, they look good, oh, this looks different, this is weird, something's happening. That's where the relevance is, I think. So I could stand up here and preach all day, but I think you need to step up and look at the bigger picture of what cybersecurity is today, because encryption is absolutely relevant, but it's at the bedrock, and it's not what people see when they approach the industry anymore. They see something else first.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I think as a product vendor, the important part of FIPS is, turn off the 57 default cipher suites that come with Apache enabled by default, and only use a subset of those things. And honestly, TLS 1.3 is going to take care of all that for us anyway, so it's going to make that go away too. But if you do that and you're running on an unvalidated module, but you've disabled the really bad stuff, that's probably like 80% of the way there.
Okay, we have this one last question.
Okay. So the question was about security being applied to, certification being applied to other industries, and we talk about IoT. There seems to be a big disconnect between what is expected on IoT and what do we expect on certification. And I say the disconnect for the simple reason of when we do a common criteria or FIPS certification, we do the platform, hardware, plus applications that are running on that all together. And that's not IoT or not what is IoT is today. IoT is to deploy a platform, deploy a piece of hardware, and upgrade that as you need with more applications and more systems. Automotive, financial, other industries are prime examples, especially in the financial industry. I mean, if you have an iPhone that you want to put your FIPS credential onto, and then you change banks, how do you redo all that FIPS credential on a secure element? Well, you can't. At this point, you can't do it because FIPS makes you recertify the entire iPhone because you changed an application. And that does not make sense in IoT space. In IoT space, you need to separate the hardware, the platform you're sitting on, from the applications that are being worked with it. So what does the panel think about that concept and how that would be fitting in more into the IoT space that we're talking about?
Well, go ahead. I was just going to say, I think that's the crux of the problem that we're talking about, which is the standards that we have were written 20 years ago in essence. And I actually remember, you know, looking at some of the early stages and dealing with how it worked for DOS. And it's not that applicable today to a smartphone, obviously. Now, the standards have changed somewhat, but they haven't changed drastically. And the whole platform, you're saying, is not applicable. But nonetheless, there is an applicable standard in my mind for my refrigerator. And I do want some security things in my refrigerator. But I don't want to become a refrigerator expert, and I don't want to have to do a lot of thinking when I'm buying my refrigerator to figure out if it's secure or not. So I do want my good housekeeping seal of approval on my refrigerator that says this thing can sit in my house behind a Fios-provided firewall or something like that and play nicely and not be a beacon for thieves trying to pull who in the neighborhood has bought milk recently or who's out of town. So if that's the only criteria for it, then we need a mechanism to have a fridge protection profile creation, or we need a new standard. And that's the debate we're having. Will there be a FIPS 140-2 Lite that is applicable to refrigerators, Or is that just a non-starter? It's way too complex and bloated, and we're going to have to come up with something from scratch, and that's what will be the IoT industry completely looking away for another standard, another testing program, some other way to do it.
Yeah, I think the point was made over here. You know, FIPS has drawn a line in the sand that said 112-bit security is the minimum we're willing to accept. Do I really need that for my refrigerator? Probably not. It's probably good enough to have 80 or 64 or some other number of just with intelligent defaults about, you know, not having backdoor passwords and that sort of thing. That's probably more important than the strength of the crypto. And the result is that 112-bit security, that might mean as a manufacturer that I have to spend, you know, $5 more on a part that can meet those requirements as opposed to the one I could get away with that does slightly less. That $5 in order to make margins turns into, you know, a $100 price uplift on the final product. That's not competitive either. So we got to, you know, federal standard says 112-bit. That may not be appropriate for all these industries, and that may be a barrier to adoption there as well.
Good point. Okay, any other last comments? Any last comments from the panel?
Good.
You've all had enough of this? First of all, I'd like to thank all of you for coming and for an interesting discussion that I know is kind of messy and difficult. So thank you so much for joining us. Nobody leave yet. There's going to be a closing presentation in just a second. But on my own behalf, thank you all for coming this year. I've been here all 4 years of this conference, and I think it's only getting better. Thanks to all the speakers and everyone who made the effort. Thanks to CNXCD Event Media Services, basically Bill and Nikki, for doing such a great job of setting the conference up like they have all the years. And hope to see everyone again next year. Divya? Do you have your disc?
Thank you.
Get your disc here.
Can we go?
So while Steve is loading that, I can start so that I don't keep you longer than you would love to. First of all, thank you. And next year, I'm going to make sure that there is a door prize for the last final presentation and for folks who are here till the last, okay? And also, next year, I'm going to make sure you get a certificate saying you were here till the end so you can show it to your bosses and say, I need a half a day.
Oops.
Because I stayed too long.
I'm sorry. It's not open.
Don't
dump on
the dot
file. Ah! Excuse me?
You can take the
dot. No.
Went to the wrong one.
Yeah.
Okay.
The top.
You know, you
that
Mac
one.
Users cause these problems.
Not the dot file.
Not the dot file.
Temporary backup.
It should be on the. Did you copy it?
Yeah, that's it at the top.
I'm sorry.
It's at the top. That's it.
The dot file.
Yeah.
Okay, try it.
Oh, this is the one that doesn't.
Which one?
The dot.
No,
this one here. That's the one that didn't open.
Yeah, I think it's corrupted.
Corrupted.
Okay.
It's.
Oh.
Just forget to win.
Yeah, but there are some good pictures too. On that.
Yeah, it won't open. Okay, sorry. Better luck next picture.
No?
Better luck next
okay.
Presentation.
All right, so I can use it again. Reusable. So again, thank you all for staying this long. I've also been here on the four years of this, and this was every year we are getting better, every year. So we did a few things different this year, and all of them were much appreciated. We went from a two-day conference to a three-day conference. We added a couple of additional new tracks. One was the CC in crypto, and the other one is the IoTs. So both were, again, appreciated. And we had multiple countries come in, multiple schemes present. So we learned a lot more about the crypto world rather than just the CMVP, NIST, NIAP things. So I do appreciate that the NIST and NIAP and CMVP, everybody came in. But I also appreciate and thank those who came in from far away, and presented to us about their crypto programs. I also want to thank, now in this context, I want to thank everybody, definitely those who came in and attended, those who presented, the volunteers who helped. There were lots and lots of volunteers who helped. It's not just us who you see up here on the front podium. There are also many others who work behind the scene, reviewing the many, many abstracts that came in. Again, thank you for all those abstracts. I know this shows interest that you have in this program and this conference. So because of all that, the quality of abstracts, we couldn't pick up everybody, but the ones that did was not, I wouldn't say that they are the only good ones, there were many others. And so I do apologize for those who did not make it in, but please try again. Let it not discourage you from not doing it all over again. So thank you for that. And I'm sure I'm missing some people because I had a list. I definitely want to thank Bill and Nikki from the CNTXDD, that is the Connected, right? That's right. So Connected, who has arranged all this facility and everything. So I do definitely want to thank the panels. We had multiple panels. We had multiple speakers, multiple international speakers. We had a game show, which was again very well received. And we had fun. We started the day in the conference, 3 days, we started by saying, let's get connected, let's share, let's talk about the different things, and let's enjoy. And I think we did all three of them. We shared the information, we got connected to each other, and we also enjoyed the conference. Yes or no? Yes?
Yes.
So thanks to each one of you for sharing, learning, and enjoying it. And again, at this point, thank you. And for the next, moving forward, what are we going to do next year? Next year, we are going to be in DC. We are thinking either at the last week of April or early May. We haven't decided because we are still working on the hotels. We are all three of us actually, Erin, myself, and Marcus, we are the chair and we do a lot of work for this. We are going to take 2 weeks of break, right? 1 week became 2 weeks now. So after 2 weeks, we are getting back onto the schedule. So please give us 2 weeks to breathe, and then we will be talking about call for papers. Call for papers is most likely going to be in October. So please think about what else you can based on this these sessions, you may have other ideas that you could say, hey, I had a good idea, why did I not share that? Now this is your opportunity. So please do contribute in terms of sending in your abstracts, and we will work on it seriously. It's going to be in the DC area, as I said, and we look forward to your continued participation in that. All right, thank you very much. Bill, do you remember if I am left out anything? Yes, good, thank you. So a few things. Please complete your survey. You'll get, in a day or two, you'll be receiving, if you haven't already started receiving. Last year, I think, even before we got out of the door, we had a survey. So please complete it. Be aware that we read every single survey and we do act upon it. So good things, we definitely like to hear. But if there are things that we can improve, we definitely would like to hear that as well. Okay, so do complete the survey. The second thing is also ICUF. Please be a part of that. Please go ahead and register yourself. And as you know, let me remind you that there is a free ticket on that for next year.
So,
yes. That was on popular demand, it went down, right?
No.
Too popular a demand, and so it went down.
Got struck by lightning.
Okay, got struck by lightning, so it's up again. So please do that. And what was the rest? Bill, do you remember? There was a couple of things on that same slide.
I'm sorry? I think that's it. I think you've got it.
Okay, all right. In any case, those slides that are invisible right now will be visible on the website. Yes, that was the other thing. The website, please, as you know, we will have all the slides of all the presentations, and some of the presentations were not on the loaded. So, but we'll make sure that they are uploaded from this, from the different tracks onto the website. So the slides will be available, and the raw audio will be available. It's not edited, but raw will be available, and I think even in 2012 is still available, so it will continue to be available as long as you want to use them. All right? Thank you once again, and bon voyage. Have a good trip home, and we hope to see you next year in DC.
I had some really good pictures.